We recorded this episode on June 9th, and we did it while self-isolating at our homes because of the novel coronavirus. Many of you may be self-isolating right now as well.
So this may sound a little different from our earlier episodes, and you might hear some background noise that we usually don't have in the studio, but that's part of the new normal that we're all adjusting to as we stay home to help flatten the curve during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Of course, the new coronavirus and COVID-19 are very much on everyone's minds, and Live Science is covering the latest news. You can find updates on our website from across the U.S., from the CDC and the World Health Organization, and from researchers around the world.
But we also hope that by continuing to bring you life's little mysteries, we can all continue to be reminded of the amazing science that's all around us.
Thanks for listening. Keep safe and stay healthy. Hello, and welcome to Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. I'm Gina Briner, Editor-in-Chief at Live Science.
And I'm Mindy Weisberger, a Senior Writer at Live Science. The world can be a pretty mysterious place, and we at Live Science love to ask and answer questions about mysteries big and small, about ancient civilizations, our planet and solar system, the plants and animals that live alongside us, our bodies and how they work, and technologies that we use every day.
Each episode of this podcast introduces mysterious questions, and we think the answers will really surprise you.
We'll also hear about cutting-edge research in labs and in fieldwork around the world to answer these and other intriguing science questions.
In today's episode of Life's Little Mysteries, we'll take a closer look at the mysterious construct that includes all of space and time, the universe. So the universe is a very big topic, and we thought it might be a good idea to start small. Where are humans in this universe? Where are we?
Right. So, because, you know, the universe is like, it can be hard to imagine, like, what that is. So, we humans, we're on a planet, which is part of a solar system, which is, then part of a galaxy. And this is the Milky Way galaxy. Which has, and within this Milky Way are about 100 billion stars. So our little solar system, which is orbiting the sun, is just, the sun is just one of 100 billion stars. And, the Milky Way is only one of many, many galaxies. And there are a lot of galaxies.
And so there are ideas that there's even more of these galaxies out there.
So by some estimates, there are 100 billion to 200 billion galaxies in the universe. That's a lot. But actually, there are other estimates that say that there are even more than that. So there were deep field images that were captured by the Hubble Space Telescope that suggested that there could be as many as 2 trillion galaxies in the observable universe.
Wow, that's a lot of stars.
Yeah.
And possibly planets.
Yep. So the universe is, it's a lot. The universe is a lot.
And so how would scientists or cosmologists, how do they define the universe if we were to break it down?
Okay. Well, so the universe, it contains all elements, energy, matter, all the contents of space. So, planets, moons, stars, galaxies, black holes, asteroids, comets, cosmic dust and gas, and all of that. And all of that is contained in this larger construct, which is known as the universe. The most common elements are hydrogen and helium, and that makes up nearly all ordinary matter. But there's also other stuff in the universe that isn't ordinary matter that can't be directly measured. But we'll get to that in a little while.
Where did our humongous universe come from? How did it begin?
Well, everything was created during the Big Bang. Which kind of makes you think of like this enormous explosion, right? I mean,
you do. You think of like a firecracker or something,
right? But the way that the Big Bang is described, maybe more of a big stretch than a Big Bang because about 13.8 billion years ago, imagine this incredibly ultra hot and very densely packed ball of matter that just suddenly and rapidly expanded in all directions at once. So it wasn't so much of an explosion as it was just this really rapid instantaneous expansion. So within milliseconds, the universe was born. Newborn universe.
What would a baby universe look like if we could see it? I don't think we have seen it.
The baby pictures would be adorable. It would be this heaving mass of neutrons, protons, and electrons and photons and other subatomic particles. So just, adorable. And a very hot baby,
hot?
Too.
Yeah.
very hot baby. Yes. Yeah, so about 100 billion degrees Kelvin. So those milliseconds after the Big Bang, things were exceptionally hot.
This was just milliseconds. So right away, all these things are bursting out in all directions. And then what happened?
Okay, so approximately about 100 seconds later, the temperature dropped to just about 1 billion degrees Kelvin. So much cooler. Still pretty hot, though. And then the universe continued to cool. So around 380,000 years later, the universe had cooled enough for protons and neutrons to come together and to start to form atoms. And there were a lot of protons that were zipping around. So, and because there were so many protons that were zipping around in the early universe, hydrogen, which is the lightest element with just one proton and one neutron, became the most abundant element. So according to NASA, nearly 95% of the universe's atoms are hydrogen.
Because I guess that was the easiest to form. It only has one neutron and one proton coming together, basically.
Exactly. Well, after that was helium, and about 5% of the universe's atoms is helium. So you've got like almost 95% and almost 5% that are just hydrogen and helium. And then it took another 200 million years for the first stars to form and then produce the rest of the elements, which make up a fraction of the remaining 1% of all ordinary matter in the universe.
That's incredible. And so, and then these stars, what happened? These stars started to cluster and to form galaxies.
Right. So then, and then the gas and dust around the stars would smash together to make planets and moons. And then gravity is the glue, if you will, that holds everything in the universe together.
Okay. So what about this stuff, this missing stuff that you were talking about earlier?
All of this ordinary matter that we talk about, this is stuff that can be observed and can be measured. But scientists have found that all of that only makes up about 5% of the universe's mass.
Okay, this is incredible to me that we know what happened 100 seconds after the Big Bang or the Big Stretch, but we don't know 95%. Of the matter in the universe is made up of.
Right. So this is all, because this is all stuff that can't be directly detected. Yeah, it makes the universe extra mysterious. And so one of these, right. So one of these is something that's known as dark matter.
Well, scientists have known about dark matter since the 1930s. And it was Swiss astronomer Fritz Zwicky who actually coined the term dark matter.
Right. So this is something that hasn't been directly observed, but is thought to account for about 85% of the matter in the universe. And one of the ways that scientists know that this exists is through these fluctuations that they see in radiation that is in the universe's first light, which is something called the cosmic microwave background. But there was actually indirect evidence for dark matter that was confirmed about 20 years ago by the astronomer Vera Rubin.
And so what was she looking at to suggest that dark matter was having its impact on the universe?
Well, she and other astronomers were looking at galaxy rotation. So galaxies as a whole rotate. And the speed of the galaxy rotation in the galaxies they were looking at implied that there was actually more mass to the galaxy than could be explained by what was observable. And that to them was indirect evidence that there was mass to the galaxy that they weren't able to see, that they weren't able to measure, and that was dark matter.
So we know that it's invisible. We can't see it. We know it's there. But what is it actually made up of?
Well, this is the question. There are some theories about dark matter that suggest that it could be, potentially invisible black holes or failed stars. But that doesn't really add up, because there wouldn't be enough of them to account for all of the dark matter that's estimated to be in the universe. So it's also possible that dark matter just could be made of particles that have been theoretically predicted, but are not yet proven to exist. So,
right.
Still a mystery.
Yeah, still a mystery here. But okay, so that accounts for how much of the universe? 85% of the matter?
Yes. So that's dark matter.
Okay. So we have this other dark thing that is out there that we also can't measure.
Right.
And that's dark energy, right?
Yes. Yes.
So
that's right.
The names imply that they are related in some way. And the only relation they have basically is that they're both invisible and can't be measured.
Right. And I think they're both, they're both called dark, but dark matter and dark energy are two separate things. So dark matter is a type of matter that hasn't been defined, whereas dark energy is a type of force, for lack of a better word. So, as far as dark energy is concerned, so after the Big Bang, the universe continued to expand, but scientists, expected that after a certain point, that the mass of the universe itself and that the force of gravity would slow or would stop its expansion. But it didn't.
Right. And that didn't happen. Okay.
Right.
And so instead, they're finding that actually the universe is increasing. The rate of expansion is getting faster and something is pushing it outward.
That's what, right. So you would think that, okay, if gravity isn't slowing it down, then there must be another force that is actually pushing everything in the universe outward. And teams of researchers discovered this in the late 1990s. They discovered that the universe expansion was actually accelerating, and they named the unknown force dark energy. And this earned the physicists that were involved in the research, that's Adam Reiss, Brian Schmidt, and Saul Perlmutter, that earned them the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2011. However, Vera Rubin did not get the Nobel Prize for her dark matter discovery, and that is quite the shame, and is something
unfortunate.
Very unfortunate, yes.
And I mean, that's been a big point of contention too, I think, that
yes,
she didn't get it, that she deserved to get that. But anyway, we all know what she did. We all know the contributions she made, I guess, but yeah, too bad.
That's right. And dark energy and dark matter, together are these two, just really, really big mysteries that are clearly very important to understanding the universe and how it works. And even more so because there's still so much about them that has yet to be unraveled.
Okay, and so dark energy makes up how much of the universe then?
Well, that's the thing is that, it gets really complicated because when you talk about measuring the mass of the universe, and so much of it is made up of stuff that you can't even directly measure at all. But scientists are able to create computer models that allow them to break it down so that based on what they have been able to indirectly observe about dark energy and dark matter, they can combine that with what is known about the matter in the universe, and then they can start to come up with numbers. So scientists modeled the force that's required to explain the universe's accelerating expansion. And so models suggest that dark energy must make up between 70 to 75% of the mass of the universe. Then dark matter accounts for about 20 to 25% of the universe's mass. And then you have so-called ordinary matter, which is all of everything else, all the stuff that we can actually see and measure. Right, and us. Right, which is just a tiny fraction. All of that altogether is estimated to make up less than 5% of the universe's mass.
Wow. And so how big is the universe right now?
So that's just the mass of the universe. But by now, the universe has expanded to about the size of about 46.5 billion light years. And this is based on calculations of how much expansion has taken place since the Big Bang.
Okay.
So that takes us through the beginning of the universe to where we are now. So most of the universe is made up of stuff we can't see or measure and don't understand. And part of that is a mysterious force that's driving universe expansion. So as much as as vast as the universe is, just the part of it that we can see in terms or can observe in terms of all of the stars and the galaxies and even black holes at this point, that's still just a tiny fraction of what makes up the universe as a whole.
Right. So what does the future hold for our universe, our ever expanding universe?
Well, that's a good question.
I mean, will things just keep expanding and everything falls apart?
We're going to talk about exactly that next.
So that is a great question. And there's plenty of doom and gloom in the world, from natural disasters to man-made catastrophes. And there's plenty of ideas about how our human civilization will end. But what about the universe itself? After we're long gone, what will happen to this vast, ever-expanding space?
Right. I mean, if the universe is still expanding, is it just going to keep on expanding until everything kind of falls apart and gravity, can it expand to a point where gravity just, stops working and everything just sort of separates from everything else? And what's going to happen next?
Well, we're going to find out, because that brings us to this episode's mystery. How will the universe end?
Okay, so you and I can't be the first ones to ask this question, obviously. Many people have, as long as people have been talking about the universe as a concept, right, there has probably been some consideration of, you know, how will it end? So what are some things that that experts have come up with?
So yes, you're right. Cosmologists have given this a lot of thought, and they've actually narrowed this down to three possible scenarios that are pretty far out there. But we are talking about the universe.
That's true. So they would have to be pretty far out there.
Yeah, exactly. So the first one is they've dubbed it heat death. And
oh, that's not dramatic at all.
No. No, the names are great for these, but so all the most of the stars, 90% of the stars, like our sun, in order to burn and light up and continue to be stars, basically, they fuse hydrogen into helium and they use that for fuel.
Okay, but there's probably only so much fuel that they can burn, and at some point they have to run out, right?
Yes, exactly. And so, right, stars don't live forever, and there's different types of stars. The less massive stars, which are about up to 10 times the mass of our sun, these, when they run out of their fuel, they collapse into what are called white dwarfs.
Okay.
So that's one ending to their life cycle. And then some of the more massive stars, they have explosive endings, and, you know, they spew out all these heavy metals, and basically they leave behind a corpse called a neutron star.
Okay. But then there are also supermassive stars. So what happens to those?
Right. Right. The big beasts of the star, the star system, these are so big and massive that they actually collapse down into black holes. So in this heat death scenario, basically all these stars are using up all their fuel and they're dying and becoming their former, you know, just skeletons of themselves. But black holes are different, and they're huge, immense gravity, basically. This idea has it that this would sort of pull in all the surrounding matter. So it's kind of like eating up all these corpses, eating up everything else.
Okay. Now, we talked about black holes specifically in an earlier episode of Life's Little Mysteries. But it's hard to imagine a universe full of nothing but black holes, or where all these supermassive stars that become black holes just start drawing in and tearing apart everything that's around them.
I know. It's a great imagery. I mean, I don't want to be here for it.
No. So, would that actually be then just like a universe full of black holes?
Well, it turns out there is something else that is also sort of siphoning off black holes. So they also have a predator, and it's called Hawking radiation. So this was named after, you know, the late Stephen Hawking, and he had postulated that there basically nothing can get out of a black hole. That's known. But in the quantum world, bizarre things happen. And his idea, which there's evidence for now, is that over time, an antimatter and matter particle will split up and one of them will tunnel out of a black hole. So it's in the quantum realm, and somehow over time, and basically it's bringing mass and energy with it. So, right. So basically it's siphoning off all this mass, taking it away from the black hole. And the idea is that over time, all these black holes would just evaporate.
Okay, you say over time. Like, how much time are we talking about?
So it's a really long time, and I don't know if I've ever gotten to use this number unit, which is a Google. Scientists think that basically this is a lot teensy bits of mass and energy over time. So it takes a very long time, and they think that after 10 to the 100 years, which is a 1 followed by 100 zeros, that's how long it would take average black holes to evaporate. And then the universe would basically be left with inert energy.
Okay. Well, yeah, I guess if black holes are sort of like, you know, if their energy is being siphoned off by like a particle at a time, yeah, that would probably take a long time to happen.
Right. A good Google to happen.
All right. So that's heat death, the heat death scenario.
Yes.
So, okay. So that's scenario number one. What's the next one?
So the next one is called the Big Crunch.
Also very dramatic.
Yes. And they've called it this because it's sort of, this scenario is basically the Big Bang in reverse. So you imagine everything you were talking about flying outward in all directions. This is sort of what you were talking about gravity. This is everything coming back.
So this is like if you take a rubber band, you stretch it really far, and then you let go.
Yes.
And then it just, everything just kind of all snaps back together.
Yes. So the gravity from stars and galaxies, instead of things flying outward, the gravity actually starts to pull everything inward. So it's literally, you know, sort of like the opposite of the Big Bang. The stars and galaxies start to pull everything in and contract, and the galactic clusters, galaxies that have formed clusters, they crash and merge. Stars and planets fuse together. So everything's coming back into this infinitely small spot, this dense ball where everything started from.
Right.
So, and that's called the Big Crunch.
Okay. I mean, there's a, you know, kind of a neatness to that, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, physicist Robert Caldwell, he's a cosmologist at Dartmouth University in Hanover, New Hampshire. And he told Live Science when we reported on this, he called this, he said, it's tidy and clean. It's like when you go camping, you leave nothing behind. So I kind of like that.
That is. It's, I guess it's kind of like, yeah, like, you know, you're eating a sandwich and, you know, it's like you take it out of the wrapper and then, you take the wrapper out of the bag. And then when you're done, you just kind of like crunch everything all up together into this little tiny ball. And then, you know, and then you throw the ball away.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This whole mess comes back together.
That's, all right. So that's, you know, another way that the universe could go. And you said there was a third one.
Yes. And this one is called the Big Rip. So we had the Big Crunch and this one is the Big Rip.
The heat death, the Big Crunch, and now the Big Rip. Okay. So what's the Big Rip?
So basically this is sort of the opposite of the Big Crunch. And instead of gravity pulling everything inward to contracting, we have that mysterious force, dark energy, which we know is causing the universe to expand at an accelerating rate. It basically pulls everything apart bit by bit, piece by piece.
Okay, so in this scenario, the Big Rip basically overcomes gravity and just pushes everything apart. Okay.
Yeah, so the universe, it keeps expanding faster and faster. And so, like, ever more close galaxies to us get farther and farther away, and it's happening so fast that basically you can't see their light anymore. They're just like soaring away from us.
Wow. Okay. So that sounds kind of terrifying.
And yeah. And so in Caldwell, the physicist also had a nice way of talking about this idea, and he said that, you know, all these closer and closer objects, as the expansion accelerates, they disappear behind what he called a wall of darkness. So we can't see their light. They're completely gone. It's as if they don't exist. And, you know, this Big Rip is sort of a free for all, and everything is literally being ripped apart down to its core.
So of these three possible scenarios, do you have a favorite?
I guess I really like the Big Rip. I mean, just because it's just so dramatic and things being ripped apart, I can just kind of like see it with sort of music in the background, things, you know, flying apart and the core being ripped out. I don't know if that's a little morbid of me. How about you?
Well, no, I what I like about that, I mean, because the thing is that does play off of what, you know, the recent discoveries about dark energy and, you know, what a powerful force dark energy is. And it does seem like if the universe does continue to accelerate, that seems like that's a very viable option for what we could, you know, what we could potentially expect as the big finale. But I have to say, there's something about the symmetry of the Big Crunch, you know, the idea that things started with the Big Bang and then they end with basically like the Big Bang, except in reverse.
Yeah, you're a very organized person, Mindy, so I think that probably appeals to you.
Oh my God.
I wish it appealed to me.
You think I organize? Can you tell my mother that?
Yes, I will.
Okay.
So, yeah, so those are our favorites.
What about scientists that study this kind of thing? Which of these scenarios seems like it's the most feasible or the most likely?
So cosmologists actually aren't sure, and one of the reasons has to do with what we've been talking about, dark energy. Its properties are so poorly understood, and we just don't know enough about it to be able to really understand how it's going to affect the expansion, how it's going to affect the future of our universe. So,
right. And we're also talking about something that's so far distant in the future that it's, you know, obviously there's, you know, astronomers, astrophysicists are able to make predictions upon timescales that are obviously far beyond the lifetime of our sun and of our solar system. But after a certain point, it can be hard to make models or predictions of how things are going to fall out. Yeah.
Right. With so many unknowns too.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And, cosmologists, physicists, they've also thrown out some other ideas, even though those are like the main, you know, the main scenarios. They're still, you know, continue to study the universe and its future. And so one of those ideas is pretty interesting to me, and it involves the Higgs boson particle, which life science has covered heavily.
Right, right. So, but okay, but yeah. So let's talk about what the Higgs boson particle is and how could it potentially cause a doomsday scenario above and beyond what we've already talked about.
So the Higgs boson particle was only discovered in 2012, but it had been theorized to exist, and it basically has an energy field that is supposed to give all other particles their mass. So it gives everything its mass. So that's a big deal. And itself, it's supposed to have a mass of, that's 126 times that of a proton. So that's much is sort of known about the Higgs boson.
Right. Now, when we talk about particles, we're talking about, you're talking about things that are the building blocks of atoms.
Yes. Yes.
So if you studied basic science, you know that atoms are made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons. But there are other particles that, like the Higgs boson, were theorized to exist and were only discovered recently. And then there are even more particles that haven't even been discovered yet.
Right. Lots and lots of them. And so one thing that scientists aren't sure about is basically whether the mass of this Higgs boson could actually change. And the reason they think that is because they think the universe might be in this state that they call an unstable false vacuum. So the universe isn't in its lowest energy configuration right now. And so if, and in the future, the Higgs decided to decay into a lower mass particle, then the universe would follow and it would become a true vacuum, basically. It would settle into its lowest energy configuration. I know that's a little bit complex, but anyway, because of the importance of the Higgs, apparently that's the scenario. That's what would happen.
That sounds kind of incredible that changes just in this single particle. I mean, obviously, it's not just one particle, but this one type of particle.
No, but it's incredible.
Yeah, that could have repercussions that could, you know, essentially doom the universe.
Right. And so there is a reason for this. So basically, because it gives everything its mass, by changing its mass and its properties, sort of things would go haywire because it has such repercussions on other particles' mass.
So what are some ways that could play out?
Physicists think that if it went to this lower energy state, this lower mass state, electrons might not be able to orbit around protons, basically. So you can say bye to atoms.
Okay.
Which, you know, make up all matter.
Okay.
So, and another thing they said, you know, perhaps photons, which are particles of light, they could develop mass. So, you know, what's hitting us from the sunshine every day are photons. And if they had mass, it would sort of feel like a rain shower, basically.
You could actually feel the sun hitting you. Yeah. Okay.
So physicists aren't sure if living creatures could survive. They really don't know what could happen. And so even though this isn't the very end, it's not the universe evaporating into inert energy, things would not look good. And so Caldwell, the physicist that we were just talking about, he said he would classify this as a sort of particle physics environmental catastrophe.
Almost along the lines of, you know, we talk about a lot about climate change and, you know, what could happen to the Earth on a global level from, you know, just these fairly small incremental changes to climate. But so this is, except this would be on the scale of the entire universe.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Like an apocalypse.
affecting things uniformly. Yeah. Not a good scenario.
No, not at all. A group of physicists is trying to solve one of the most enduring questions out there, literally. Why are we all here at all? And they've come up with an interesting, at least a step toward answering that. And here to talk about his article on this research is Live Science staff reporter Rafi Letzter. Thanks so much for joining us, Rafi.
Of course, thanks for having me.
So what is this big question that the physicists are trying to answer?
So we have this big mystery, and the mystery is that we exist, that matter exists in the universe, that there's anything around us to look at all besides a big, bright burst of light. And the reason that's a mystery is because our universe has matter and antimatter, the substance that should cancel out matter, should have wiped it out at the beginning of time. And in most ways, matter and antimatter balance each other out. You know, in matter, you have atoms of hydrogen. In antimatter, you can have atoms of anti-hydrogen. In matter, you have neutrinos. In antimatter, you have anti-neutrinos. You know, that there's this really even canceling out that antimatter does to matter. And this is called, generally speaking, CP symmetry.
And so would that include humans, why we are even here today?
As far as we know, from very soon after the Big Bang, there was both matter and antimatter in the universe. And most of the research we have suggests there should have been about the same amount of matter and antimatter in the universe, which really means they should have entirely canceled each other out and turned into energy. And that didn't happen. Matter came to dominate the universe, and antimatter got almost entirely wiped out. You know, it's pretty hard to find antimatter in our day-to-day lives. There isn't that much of it around. So there's this question, how did it happen? What gave matter the advantage over antimatter? And that's really the big question that physicists are trying to solve here.
What are they looking at in particular to get to the bottom of this conundrum?
So these physicists are looking for CP violations, places where the symmetry between matter and antimatter is broken, where there's some difference between matter and antimatter.
Okay.
And we know this exists. You know, going back to 1964, researchers looking at quarks, these very, very basic particles that make up atoms, there's some meaningful difference between quarks and antiquarks. But it's not that big an asymmetry. It's not enough that would explain how matter came to dominate antimatter in the universe. But it shows that there are these asymmetries out there. And if you look for them, you might be able to find more asymmetries that might actually explain how the universe came to exist.
So how would such a difference change what was left in the universe after the Big Bang?
What these researchers are looking for specifically is an asymmetry in leptons. And leptons are this whole other category of matter. They include particles like electrons, which are in atoms, and particles like neutrinos, which are much harder to detect, much fainter. And these physicists are looking for asymmetries, for CP violations between the lightest forms of neutrinos and the lightest forms of antineutrinos.
And what would an asymmetry mean here?
An asymmetry here just means they're behaving differently. They don't do exactly the same thing under the same conditions. And in this case, what they're looking for is differences in how they oscillate. So oscillation is this thing neutrinos do where they jump back and forth between different types of neutrinos. So there are three flavors of neutrino we know about, the electron, the muon, and the tau neutrinos. And we know that as a neutrino travels through space, it can spontaneously stop being an electron neutrino and turn into a muon neutrino, or stop being a tau neutrino and turn into an electron neutrino. This jumping back and forth happens, and it's part of how they exist in the universe. And we know that antineutrinos, that the antimatter correspondence of neutrinos, also do this. They also oscillate back and forth. But neutrinos are very difficult to study, and no one's ever really determined whether neutrinos and antineutrinos oscillate in exactly the same way. And that's what the researchers are looking for, an asymmetry between the oscillations of neutrinos and antineutrinos, which, if they found it, which they think they did, would suggest that there's this larger asymmetry in all of the leptons, this whole class of matter. Uh-huh. And they think that that might actually explain how matter came to dominate antimatter in the universe.
The collaboration's experiment sounds so mysterious, involving a cavern deep beneath Earth's surface. What's happening down there?
There's a mountain in Japan, and deep under the mountain, there's this very still, very dark tank of water, and it's called the Super Kamiokande Detector. The reason it's so dark and so quiet and so still, and they bury it under a mountain, is because they're trying to block out all other forms of radiation, anything else that could be influencing this tank, so that only neutrinos are getting through and getting into it and interacting with the water.
And what is it about neutrinos that they have to be so careful about?
Neutrinos, unlike almost any other particle we know about, can pretty much pass through anything. At low energies, they just slip through steel and lead. and rock as if it's nothing. So 183 miles away from this tank of water, also underground, there's a neutrino beam generator, and it just fires a beam of neutrinos straight at the Super Kamiokande detector. And it goes through the Earth, but it kind of ignores the Earth. This beam ends up passing through the tank of water.
And what exactly are they looking for in the tank of water?
So you have muon neutrinos and electron neutrinos passing through the tank. The reason a muon neutrino is called a muon neutrino, and the reason an electron neutrino is called an electron neutrino, is that when they do hit something else, you know, smack into a water molecule, for example, they transform, and the muon neutrino will transform into this other particle called a muon, and the electron neutrino will transform into this other particle called an electron, which you might have heard of. And as muons and electrons pass through the tank of water, which does happen sometimes, the neutrinos sometimes slam into the water molecules, they create a very faint ring of light, which these very sensitive cameras around the detector can pick up. You and I probably wouldn't be able to see it, but it is there. And there's a difference between the ring of light from a muon passing through the tank, which is very sharp and clearly defined. It looks like a ring. And the ring of light you get from an electron passing through the tank. Basically, over years and years and years of this neutrino beam being shot into the tank of water, researchers have been looking for a difference between the number of electron rings passing through the tank and the number of muon rings passing through the tank, depending on whether true neutrinos or antineutrinos are being shot into the water. So they're looking for, are the neutrinos oscillating in the same way as the antineutrinos? Are they jumping back and forth between muon and electron the same number of times?
What have the physicists found so far?
You know, these rings of light aren't that common. It's taken a long time to build up enough data. But now the collaboration that's responsible for this experiment says they are 95% confident that there's a difference between how the antineutrinos and the neutrinos are oscillating and the beams of light that they're producing in this tank of water. They want to collect more data. 95% certain is pretty certain, but physicists like to be a lot more certain than that.
Okay, so why is this such a big deal? Have physicists never found any discrepancies before?
This is the first real solid piece of evidence we have that there is this asymmetry in the leptons, this asymmetry that might explain how the universe came into being. This is only looking at two leptons, basically, the muon neutrino and the electron neutrino, and their antineutrino components. But if there's a difference between them, if they are oscillating differently, if there's an asymmetry there, that suggests that other leptons probably also have asymmetries, that there are other ways in which the leptons are asymmetrical from each other. And if you wind back the clock to when matter was winning out over antimatter in the battle to control the universe, it sort of isn't important what sort of matter actually won that battle, because matter can kind of go back and forth between different types of particle that all you have to have happen is some matter wins. Mm-hmm. And for that to happen, you just have to have a really big asymmetry somewhere. So what they're suggesting is this asymmetry might be big in the leptons. There might be enough asymmetry that the early matter particles that won out in the universe were things like electrons and neutrinos and muons and tau particles, these more unusual particles that don't make up as much of the substance of the world around us mm-hmm. that we're used to seeing. And then over time, once matter won out, then you would start to see hydrogen and oxygen and all these particles we're used to come into being.
So what's next? Collecting more data?
Yeah, so there's sort of two avenues they're taking. One is to keep collecting the data they're already collecting, you know, over time. If what they've collected so far is correct, they'll only become more and more confident with more data. Or maybe more data will start to suggest maybe they weren't as correct as they thought. And then the other plan is to build an even bigger tank of water, you know, something even more super than Super Kamiokande, and that this tank of water will be even more sensitive. It'll pick up even more of these electron and muon flashes, and that this will allow them to collect data more quickly.
I've been talking to Rafi Letzter, live science reporter. You can read his article, Flickers of Light in a Giant Underground tank of water in Japan could explain the entire universe on the Live Science website. The link is in the show notes. Rafi, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us today for Life's Little Mysteries with Live Science. Today's universe mystery, How Will the Universe End, is available as a Life's Little Mysteries article on our website, livescience.com.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter for even more Life's Little Mysteries and for the latest science news. You can also join the conversation in our Live Science forums, where you can pose Life's Little Mysteries questions of your own or even suggest topics for upcoming podcast episodes. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss out on new episodes.
What will we talk about next? It's a mystery.
Literally. It'll be another Life's Little Mystery.
Life's Little Mysteries is produced in conjunction with Audio Boom as part of their Audio Boom Originals network.